So this hour, we're talking about masculinity in America, and there's a history to this conversation. Back in the 1970s, era of Ms. Magazine, Gloria Steinem, Betty Friedan, there was a smaller, less publicized men's liberation movement. And then in the late 70s, that movement split into two camps, a pro-feminist faction and the anti-feminist men's rights movement, which sees men as an oppressed group. And critics have accused them of creating a breeding ground for misogyny, internet trolling, and violence against women. The father of the men's rights movement is Warren Farrell. He's the author of the core text of the movement, The Myth of Male Power. Steve Paulson sat down with him for a candid talk about men's rights and masculinity in America today.
Do you think boys now are confused about what they're supposed to be, what it means to be a man?
Absolutely. In the old days, being a man was, in a sense, a disaster. Every society that survived based on its ability to train its sons to be disposable. So boys trained to be heroes by being disposable in war. They might train to be disposable in the workplace and oil rigs and coal mines and construction sites and so on. But because they were earning money, they at least felt they had a sense of purpose. So the good news that's happened is that we have fewer boys going to war, especially as a mandate. We have a smaller percentage of people dying in the workplace. But boys often feel that they don't have, what should they do? There's been a purpose void, but they're sort of looking around and saying, well, do I want to be like my dad? That's the primary sort of role model. And oftentimes their dad does not look happy, is not happy.
Why would this be any more confusing for boys than for girls now? I mean, do you think girls have an easier time of sort of finding their way and sort of knowing what to shoot for than boys do?
The blessing that the women's movement gave to girls and women was basically saying to girls, let's say there's you're married and you're both man and woman have a job and relatively decent job. And the woman becomes pregnant. The woman says basically to herself, I have three options here. Option one is to be full-time involved with my children. Option two is to be full-time involved with my workplace. Option three is to do some combination of both. The man just sort of sits back and he says, oh yeah, I have three options too. Option one is work full-time. Option two is work full-time. Option three is work full-time. And then if he earns a great deal of money, he calls it power. But power, if you feel obligated to earn money that often somebody else spends while you die sooner, I think that's a very deficient definition of power. But boys have bought into that such a fundamental level, and there's been no men's movement to help boys question that paradigm.
Whether this is the kind of power they would really want. Because, I mean, the irony, of course, is that, you know, in most positions of power in our society, men still dominate. You know, they make up the vast majority in Congress, of corporate boards, you know, all those kind of big, powerful places that we see in society. But you're saying maybe that's, you know, not necessarily something that most boys actually want to aspire to.
That's right. And they're looking at their own lives and saying, do I really want to be working 80 hours a week, 70 hours a week to spend my life subservient to somebody that as I climb the ladder to get to the top of a ladder that's leaning on a wall that I don't want to be on. And so a lot of what is happening among boys today, among the brighter boys, is an unconscious wisdom, of do I really want to be doing what my dad is doing? And the answer is often no. My dad, especially if he's divorced, I have very minimal contact with him. I feel rudderless. I don't have good guidance. And so that boy is sort of really very much in a lost place. But even if his dad is doing well, he often sees an unhappy dad who doesn't have that glint in his eye. And feeling obligated to do anything is not about power. Being told you will be a hero if you go to war and die for us is a social bribe to die.
So I want to bring in the men's rights movement here and sort of what this is a response to, because you are commonly called the father, the intellectual father of the men's rights movement. What do you see as the goal here, as the value of this movement?
the men's rights movement in its sort of current form is like someone who is shouting to be heard for 30 years and has not been heard. And when people shout to be heard, they get hurt, they get mean, they distort, they do anything to get attention. And so many people in the men's rights movement are highly intelligent and thoughtful. Other people in the men's rights movement feel that women have gotten a lot of opportunities that men don't have, and that nobody sees the opportunities that men don't have. And because no one is listening and has given them credence, they are often shouting just to get the attention. So that, you know, the best thing we can do.
And we should point out, I mean, there is a nasty side to all of this. As one reporter has called it, you know, it's an army of misogynists and trolls on the internet in particular. So that, I mean, you're not discounting that. You're saying that is there.
Yes. Well, first of all, it isn't an army of, but many of the people in the men's movement are so hurt and in such pain that they're shouting out. And when people don't get heard, as in any relationship, they start getting meaner and meaner and angrier and saying things that are in the extreme, because the first need of all people is to be heard. And so if we want to do the best we can is hear everyone, hear instead of saying trolls or army of, let's say, what are they trying to say that we aren't hearing? When the women's movement first surfaced, I remember, and I was on the board of NOW in New York City, as you know, I remember being on the Barbara Walters show, in the Today show, and Barbara Walters said, well, how can you be part of a movement where you have people like Kate Millett, who is bisexual? This was a number of years ago when this was considered not okay, even by somebody progressive like Barbara Walters. And I said, Barbara, first of all, people who are bisexual may see the heterosexual world more clearly than we do. Why don't we open our ears to what the women's movement is saying? And instead of calling them dykes and bra burners, why don't we hear their best intent? Why don't we hear what is not being articulated? And that led me to spending a good part of my life supporting the women's movement and trying to articulate to men who were feeling threatened by it what the women's movement's best intent was.
And we should just reiterate this point, because, I mean, this is kind of fascinating. I mean, you who are so identified with the men's rights movement, I mean, back in the 70s, you worked for the National Organization for Women. You were on NOW's New York City chapter board. You were called the Gloria Steinem of men's liberation. I think that's going to surprise a lot of people.
And really, the myth of male power was really inspired in many respects by Betty Friedan's second book, a second major book called The Second Stage, in which she said that we've done a great job with women, and now we have to focus on men. And if we don't focus on men, the second stage of the women's movement, we will be in trouble. And I started researching the myth of male power and saw, yes, men are already in trouble, and we have to start listening. But there's an underlying reason that we don't listen to men, and that is because part of what toxic masculinity is about is men, in order to become successful, have to learn to repress their feelings, not express their feelings. So when a man is feeling down and depressed, we don't hear about it, but he may act out instead, like drinking, driving, or getting DUIs. And so the parents focus on the DUIs, and that we don't focus on the hurt and the pain that is leading to the DUIs, the questions that aren't being asked. And we have things, for example, like, you know, we have, I think it's 6 offices, federal offices of women's health. We have no offices of men's health, even though men die sooner. If we consider ourselves progressive and liberal, we need to see the pain of men as well as women, and boys as well as girls. And that's our next evolutionary mandate.
Where does the current political scene fit into all of this? Because some of these ideas are getting played out within the white nationalist movement, what's been called the alt-right, and a certain kind of hyper-masculinity has surfaced. I mean, it clearly seems to be part of the appeal of this movement, and also would seem to relate to electing Donald Trump as president. What do you make of the ascendancy of this particular piece of our culture?
I think the ascendancy of sort of the Trump type of era is boys and men who have felt unheard and now feel that somebody who is speaking like they speak, but is not a loser like they're afraid of being if they opened up their mouth, because he is a billionaire. And so they can sort of say, okay, if a billionaire who's really successful is speaking like I'm speaking, maybe I have something to say and maybe I should be heard. And so I worked very, very hard with the top advisors of the Clinton campaign to ask them to open up an avenue for boys and men to be heard, to sort of say, to acknowledge that there is a boy crisis, to acknowledge that there is a crisis of fatherlessness, and to say how important it is to keep fathers in the family. That was not heard by Hillary Clinton, I'm afraid. And so she, in my opinion, left out an enormous population. I contributed significantly to her campaign, as my wife did. I'm a strong supporter of her. I like her. I thought she would not be a good president. I thought she'd be a great president. But yet, she left this enormous hole open that she was not willing to go into and to deal with. And so we got a boy in the White House. we got somebody who, you know, any mother who's training their son to be a emotionally intelligent boy is training their son to do things and be differently than the person who will be our next president. And that's deeply, deeply sad. But we have gotten what we have neglected.
What about the phrase man up, which we hear all the time? One of our guests in this hour considers it the most destructive phrase in the English language. What do you make of that phrase, man up?
I would agree with one of your guests. Man up is basically social pressure. There's two ways we get men to do what we want them to do. That does not serve the man, but serves the society. We have to always remember that what served the society does not serve the man. Every society survived based on its ability to train its sons to be disposable in war. Being in war served the protection of the society, but it created in men characteristics that were extremely unhealthy to men. One of the ways we did that was telling him, man up. So even today, as we speak, men are expected to register when they're 18 for the draft. Not expected to, they're required to. If they don't do so, they have $250,000 fine. They're put in prison for 5 years. After 5 years in prison, they cannot get any federal jobs, any state jobs. They cannot even, in many states, not even get their driver's license. Do men complain about it? No. Why? Because men have internalized learning to man up. If women were required to register for the draft with those types of penalties, if they didn't, and men were not, millions of women would speak out. They would make it politically unable to continue as a policy to be the only gender to register for the draft. So we've created an era of what I would call the multi-option woman and the no-option man.
But what about those men who clearly are misogynistic, you know, let's say at a men's rights conference or online and just saying nasty things about women? Do you feel it's your responsibility as one of the intellectual leaders of this movement? And you do feel like other leaders have a responsibility to speak out and say, hey, this is wrong. Stop it.
Yeah, my first response to all misogyny or misandry, like the Scum Manifesto that we talked about before, my first response to a Valerie Solanas when she's, you know, saying this, there should be a society for cutting up men, or for a man that is saying that, you know, don't ever get married, all women are, you know, it's just basically prostitutes or whatever they might say, my first response is to listen. When you hear somebody, they start their anger, especially if you say, you know, what I heard you say was this or what I heard you say was that, and it's an accurate reflection of what they're saying, then you begin to lower their temperature to what they're really feeling and how they're really hurting. So I want to get to the pain behind women in the women's movement who were filled with anger, that were always called anti-male, who were, you know, bra burners, that they would say, or just, you know, women who were really speaking negatively about men. And I want to get to the bottom of what the guys are feeling when they are speaking out so negatively and destructively about women, and therefore self-destructively, because any man who speaks like that is also being self-destructive as well. And then once I hear him, I want to be able to share some other perspectives that allow him to see something different once he is not in anger mode. I do go on shows for everyone who asks me, you know, where there is a group of people who will listen and hear, and I present what I feel are the real issues. And I hope that the real issues allow people to feel heard enough so that their anger is significantly reduced.
Well, thank you so much. This has been a pleasure to talk with you.
It's been a real pleasure to talk with you, too. I thank you for caring enough to ask and listening so well.
Warren Farrell is one of the founders of the men's rights movement and author of the 1993 book, The Myth of Male Power. Steve Paulson talked with him.